From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. On Tuesday, Republican Bob Turner defeated Democrat David Weprin to take control of New York's 9th Congressional District, the seat vacated by Anthony Weiner after a spring scandal. This was widely reported in the press as a possible bellwether for 2012, a sign that voter frustration with President Obama had trickled down even into New York politics.
A stunning upset seen as a wake-up call for the White House.
In a district where Republicans are outnumbered 3-1. It's shocking.
It seems like the whole world's just tilting on its head now.
It is seen as a stinging rejection of President Obama and his policies.
But was this a bellwether, or was it another phenomenon altogether? An example of the media taking a single data point and turning it into a narrative. Political stat guru Nate Silver wrote about this for the New York Times. Nate, welcome back to OTM.
Yeah, thank you.
So one possibility is that the loss of this hitherto fairly safe Democratic seat to a Republican does presage nationwide rebuke of the Democrats and of the Obama administration in the fall. Can we begin by exploring why that actually may be the case?
There were actually two special elections on Tuesday night, one in New York and the other in Nevada. The Democrats lost both, and the one in Nevada they probably weren't favored to win, but they lost it by 22 points in a district that Barack Obama had come very close to winning in 2008. So you can make one set of excuses in one case. I think the excuses might not be bad in New York as far as it being a quirky district. But when you have two of these cases on one night, you certainly see evidence that we have, you know, maybe not a tsunami or something coming, but some problems, a little bit of flooding into areas where Democrats had hoped to do better, which would forebode a rough night for them next November.
Yeah, and in ninth grade geometry, we learned that 2 points does determine a line. On the other hand, this isn't geometry we're talking about. Do these two results represent to you projectable data?
Well, from my point of view, it would be great if we had 24 congressional districts voting every month, you know, where you constantly rotated people. Then we'd have a really good tangible sign of the mood of the country. But 2 is not all that many, certainly out of 435. Remember also, as recently as May, Democrats won a seat from Republicans in upstate New York in a Republican-leaning district. I mean, at the time, there was a lot of talk about that being a referendum on Medicare and so forth.
Okay, but give me the argument, please, for why this is, in fact, not projectable and may in absolutely no way presage anything.
I think there are 3 basic points here. Number one being that the political climate has been very volatile so far this year, as we see from what happened in the May special election, which was way in favor of Democrats versus today. Number two, particularly in the New York district, I'm not sure you can extrapolate the demographics there to others elsewhere in the country. Number three, you don't have any incumbents on the ballot in these cases. By definition, you have a special election when an incumbent leaves office. And one question here is, you know, there's going to be a partisan shift one way or the other. We don't know which way yet. There may be on top of that an anti-incumbent wave. We have record levels of dissatisfaction with the Congress in lots of polls. There are surveys now saying most people want to boot their own member of Congress out of office, not just the ones in other districts. That number's never been seen before in polls. So we don't know what happens when you have Democratic and Republican incumbents on the ballot next November. You could have a case where both parties lose quite a few seats.
So this gets back to where I started on this. Does the press really have any business trying to use a single special election to represent something as broad as the results of a presidential election 14 months hence?
With the right context, this is absolutely a story that should be covered. You know, on a 0-10 scale, you know, it's about a 6 or 7 as far as newsworthiness goes compared to what happens on a typical day. Without that context, you're basically repeating spin. The spin can get pretty desperate on both sides, especially the losing side, you know. And I think if you look at the data, it does support the idea that Democrats should be worried. But I think some of the headlines don't necessarily do the topic justice.
Well, yeah, the lead up to the election was the week of 9/11 commemoration. And the story got pushed out of the agenda by all things 9/11. And then by a Republican unseating a Democrat in this district became a kind of man-bites-dog, right? But the question is it man bites dog, or is it an augury of things to come?
Look, you're getting this drip, drip, drip of information. I think this is a larger and more important drip than a new poll or something, but this is a very, very long kind of perpetual campaign. We are still 14 months removed from when people will be voting again in November, and so, you know, it's all a matter of proportionality, understanding that in the long run, Democrats are going to win some news cycles and Republicans will too. Republicans will certainly win this one.
All right. Nate, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Nate Silver writes the 538 blog for the New York Times. Responsibly divining trends is one chronic difficulty for the press in an election year. An even more problematic one is divining divinity. Though the critical issues are war, the economy, social welfare, and taxation, more than ever, those matters are being framed through the lens of religion. A few weeks back, Republican presidential hopeful Rick Santorum was pressed by CNN's Piers Morgan about whether he thought homosexuality is a sin. Santorum replied that the question should be asked of a cleric, not a politician.
You did invite me to ask you any question I liked.
Yeah, I did. And of course, the Catholic Church teaches that homosexuality is a sin. I'm a Catholic and I subscribe to the Catholic Church's teaching. But that's not relevant from the standpoint of how I view these issues from a public policy point of view. And that's why I answered the question the way I did.
Amy Sullivan writes about religion and politics for Time. In a recent essay, she declared that journalists repeatedly make spectacles of themselves by asking a theological question when a policy question will do.
There was really no reason to bring religion into this question. The end result they wanted to get to was what policy would Rick Santorum support in terms of civil unions or allowing gay couples to marry. Whether his views on that were informed by his Catholicism or by completely secular reasons really shouldn't matter to voters.
So you believe that in questioning candidates, reporters should just leave the faith part out of it and get right to the policy at issue?
Well, reporters need to be careful that they're asking relevant questions and not simply trying to use religion as part of the political circus. Take, for example, questions about evolution and creationism. Bringing up evolution highlights if this person doesn't believe in evolution, he's backwards.
When candidates go on the stump speaking of their faith and invoking religious-based values that often are explicitly in conflict with secular law, does it not behoove the press to find out where their faith ends and their commitment to secular law begins?
Certainly, when a candidate raises their faith on the campaign trail, and particularly when they present their faith as part of their political persona, as part of the reason to vote for them, reporters have not just a right but a responsibility to push on that. But again, I think the questions have to be relevant. We have to deal with the fact that we have no religious test for office in this country.
No official religious test.
No official
fact,
religious test.
In fact, every candidate must have that box checked, right? I mean, every candidate makes some sort of public profession of faith, has photo ops at church, is shown with their pastor or spiritual advisor, and make sure that it's clear that, you know, God forbid, they're not atheists.
This is a really recent development in American politics. People ask me all the time, could an atheist be elected president? And the answer right now is no, absolutely not. And the only way we're going to get there, I think, is to take religion out of the conversation where it's not relevant and reserve it for those situations in which we really need to press candidates to explain why they're bringing up their religion.
I also want to ask you about the out-of-touch secular journalist. What do we have to do to be more in touch?
Well, one of the things I think would help is for journalists to learn the language of some of the religious communities that they end up covering when they cover candidates. And one of the examples I like to point to is the evangelical habit of referring to being called to do something. George Bush referred to a call he felt to run for president. In this cycle, both Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann have talked about being called to run for president. And this has provided fodder for a lot of our journalistic colleagues.
Would God guide your decisions that you would make as president of the United States? Well, as President of the United States, I would pray. I would pray and ask the Lord for guidance. That's what presidents have done throughout history.
But George, you said
Washington
that
God Abraham
called
Lincoln
me to
did.
Run for Congress.
In fact, that formulation, being called, is just a very common way for evangelicals to talk about a sense that there's something that they feel like they should do. So to see David Gregory on Meet the Press really grilling Michelle Bachmann about whether God did or did not call her to run for president, to me, just revealed that David Gregory doesn't know much about evangelical Christians. And it didn't tell voters much at all about Michelle Bachmann.
Give me the three commandments.
Three commandments that I would give journalists in covering religion are: one, no Margaret Mead questions. Questions that try to look at religious traditions as kind of exotic, undiscovered Amazonian tribes who need to be explained. Second would be learn the language. This is a way for journalists to know if a candidate is trying to send under-the-radar signals or if they're just simply speaking the natural language of millions of Americans who are people of faith. And the third is stop calling candidates devout. This is something you read whenever there is a piece about particularly a Republican candidate's religion. They're described as a devout Mormon or a devout Catholic. And all it seems to serve to do is to say this is a conservative person of faith. What journalists really mean by devout is they go to church all the time. Or this is somebody who keeps the Sabbath, is an Orthodox Jew, and who is observant. If that's what they mean, they should say it. I think the phrase devout is kind of lazy journalistic shorthand and doesn't tell us a lot about a candidate's faith or religiosity.
All right, Amy. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was fun.
Amy Sullivan writes about religion and politics for Time. Coming up, Sarah Palin, a People magazine reading party girl Nordstrom shopper. Read all about it in Doonesbury. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. In the spring of 2010, author Joe McGinnis made headlines when he decided to move into a vacant house next door to Sarah and Todd Palin in order to write a book about them. Here's Todd Palin talking about McGinnis on the reality TV show Sarah Palin's Alaska.
Our summer fun has been kind of taken away from us because of a new neighbor next door who's writing a hit piece on my wife. I mean, life's about being productive, but these people want to seek and destroy.
The Palins responded to McGinnis's presence by building a 14-foot fence. Meanwhile, in Gary Trudeau's comic strip Doonesbury, the fictional Fox News reporter Roland Headley moved in next door to McGinnis and began watching his every move. Now the real world and the world of Doonesbury have collided, as Trudeau has gotten first serial rights for Joe McGinnis's book, The Rogue, Searching for the Real Sarah Palin. And this week, he worked excerpts into the narrative of the comic. Gary, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, Bob.
So let's talk about the mechanism you used to make McGinnis's book, The Rogue, fit within the framework of the Doonesbury strip. And you do it through your character, Roland Headley, who is a Fox News reporter. What's his brief with respect to The Rogue?
Well, he acquires the manuscript for $10 from someone who has no idea what its value might be in the media market, and takes it to his boss at Fox and proposes that he tweet its contents. And his boss, Roger, counsels him to make sure that he's got Sarah's back, because Sarah Palin is, of course, a Fox contributor. So his challenge is to reframe the contents of the book in such a way that puts her in the best possible light. And that turns out to be a huge challenge for him.
To spin McGinnis's revelations into something that redounds to the benefit of Sarah Palin.
In terms of finding the comedy in it, that was probably the best approach. And I can't really justify doing it if I can't make it funny. That is sort of the agreement I have with readers.
You have described the manuscript as an embarrassment of riches for a cartoonist, right?
Palin is an elite club of public figures that cartoonists and comedians just can't stay away from. I would put in that club Dan Quayle and Donald Trump, somebody whose aspirations and grandiosity just outstrip what's possible in the real world. It's almost impossible for someone in my line of business to resist. So having this manuscript, if I hadn't done something with it, it would have been professional malpractice.
The McGinnis book got slaughtered by Janet Maslin in the New York Times because she said it was petty and gossipy and often uncorroborated and maybe most indicting, very thin on the very salacious material that it seems to promise.
The reason that I considered the book was that Joe McGinnis has written some classics of investigative reporting through the years. And this isn't a question of me taking somebody with an axe to grind or somebody without a reputation and fanning the embers and making more of it than should be. This is somebody whose book is going to be widely considered in the next week. You know, I had a choice to make. Am I going to take this opportunity to comment on the book before everybody else or with everybody else?
The Chicago Tribune and a couple of other papers declined to run the strip this week because they say it does not, on fairness grounds, meet their journalistic criteria for even-handedness. What's your take on that?
Well, I'm a cartoonist, so I'm by definition unfair. I mean, that's what satire is. And for the first 25 years of my career, I was routinely thrown out of newspapers. And every editor has that judgment call to make, and I never second-guessed them on that. You know, I think that I got the balance right in the six strips that appear this week. The first three are about Sarah in office and her behavior in office. Today's strip about Glenn Rice.
He's the former NBA star
right. Whom
the book alleges had a fling with young Sarah Palin 24 years ago.
Well, it should be said, as does Glenn Rice.
That's all you got for me, Gary? You know, an affair 25 years ago with a basketball player?
It's not all I got for
what,
you.
Who cares?
I have a half a dozen strips, and you can decide how important each of them are in appraising. The following two strips on Friday and Saturday involve her family life. Well, now, normally, I think most people say, well, I'll stay away from the family. Certainly, Palin would prefer us to stay away from the family, except on her terms. Watch my reality show in which I trot them all out.
One final thing on the issue of the liberal media predictably attacking Sarah Palin yet again. Do you expect that Tea Party rallies all around the country, people will be brandishing newspapers with the Doonesbury strip in them and citing them as 7 days of smoking guns about bias in the media and destruction of American values?
I have no idea. I mean, you're talking to someone who's received hate mail for 40 years. So professionally, I have a fairly thick skin or I wouldn't be in this business. But the Sarah Palin week is actually 1 week in a 6-week story involving a half a dozen characters. So, you know, I've already written the week that follows. I'll move on. And I'm sure everyone else will, too.
Gary, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Bob.
Gary Trudeau is the author of Doonesbury. Amateur radio enthusiasts, aka hams, get their kicks from communicating off the grid with other hams. But for some, talking to people around the neighborhood or even around the country isn't enough. These hams seek the thrill of making contact with what they call entities, far-flung countries like Albania or tiny Pacific islands. The contact can be brief. It's often little more than the ham equivalent of, hey, I'm here, do you hear me? And then, yeah, I hear you. But hams collect these moments, and having a lot of them assures prestige in their very rarefied, very nerdy band of the ionosphere. When an actual new country joins the community of nations, the hams go hog wild. Consider South Sudan. When it became a sovereign country in July, hams around the world were naturally eager to check in. But there were no South Sudanese ham stations to check in with. Enter the Intrepid De-Expedition Group, an international team of radio heads who this summer made their way to the fledgling republic, lugging hundreds of pounds of equipment with which to transmit and receive.
More than 100,000 hams from around the world made contact with the de-expedition team. Paul Ewing was one of the hams who went to South Sudan. We spoke to him from the capital, Juba. Paul, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
In these days of Skype and cell communication, isn't amateur radio more or less obsolete?
Internet here is very slow and very poor. Cell phone coverage is very small and minute. Amateur radio is about the only reliable communication in a place where a very primitive infrastructure is in place.
There's something almost poetic in the sound of a ham signing on and making contact. Can you give me an idea of what that sounds like?
Yeah, so for example, our radio call sign is Sugar Tango Zero Radio.
This is Sugar Tango Zero Radio, now looking outside of Europe. Looking outside of Europe, listening 14245 outside of Europe. QRZ.
QRZ for any calls. That means give us a call. We're here listening for you. A large amount of people will call us, often hundreds or thousands of people at one time.
Tell me about the content. Are they all just, hey there, how you doing? Or is there anything of consequence being said?
Most of the conversations are very brief and to the point, and then we log them into our log so that later on we exchange postcards with each other. It's a long-standing ham radio tradition, and these are often quite artistic and very fancy and very meaningful to the people that get them.
What did you find when you arrived there? This is a country without much infrastructure, virtually no economy. It's a dangerous place. It's still violent. What have you discovered there?
The people of South Sudan are very genuine, very warm, very friendly and welcoming. We're very impressed that everybody speaks English very eloquently. We understand about the conflicts occurring in Abaya and other border regions that are still in dispute. But here in Juba, there's so much enthusiasm and so much excitement about the birth of the country and the future ahead for the people of South Sudan. It's really quite something to experience this.
These expeditions aren't necessarily all fun and games. When your group tried to create an outpost in Afghanistan, the outcome was not good.
Yes, that's correct. In early May of this year, we developed a contact working for NATO in Kabul, and he was an amateur radio operator. Unfortunately, he was killed in an attack by an Afghan soldier just a few days before we were set to arrive. We still had planned to continue coming to Kabul. His co-workers would help us retrieve our equipment and carry on. But then with the announcement of the killing of Osama bin Laden, then we decided that that was enough and we should cancel our plans. The hotel that we had planned to use, the Kabul Intercontinental, was blown up just a few weeks later, so it was very fortuitous that we canceled our plans.
You are, as a ham radio operator, by definition, a mega nerd. And you have gone to this place which turns out to be most welcoming. But you really didn't know that you would be going to someplace safe and secure. You're kind of like a nerd ninja, no?
Well, I don't know about that. I think we're actually pretty cautious. We did a lot of research. That's typically what we do when we go to countries. For example, in April of 2010, my team went to a very friendly area of Iraq known as Kurdistan. Who could imagine that a group of 14 international amateur radio operators could go to Iraq and spend 12 days and have the time of their lives, and yet with our research, we determined that we could do this.
New countries aren't formed every day. Have you any plans beyond Juba?
As a matter of fact, we've had some very interesting meetings here in Juba with the former Minister of Foreign Affairs for the country of Somaliland. So we're looking into that for possibly next year.
Well, Paul, it's been a delight. Talk to you soon from some country as yet undesignated.
Very nice to talk to you today. Thank you.
Paul Ewing was the co-leader of the Intrepid DX Group's voyage to South Sudan. He's an example of someone who will go to extremely great lengths to receive radio waves. There is a smaller cohort of people, and a much less enthusiastic one, who go to similar trouble to avoid radio waves altogether. They are the sufferers of what they call EHS, electromagnetic hypersensitivity,
which they say afflicts them with debilitating headaches, rashes, muscle spasms, and other symptoms. So severely are they affected by radio broadcasts, Wi-Fi, electromagnetic emanations of power lines, appliances, and so on, that some have fled to a remote West Virginia refuge called the U.S. Radio Quiet Zone. BBC reporter Matt Danzico made a trip recently to Green Bank, West Virginia, the epicenter of Radio Free America.
Well, Green Bank sits in the heart of the Radio Quiet Zone, an area that's about 13,000 square miles large. And in the Radio Quiet Zone is the world's largest steerable radio telescope that monitors space. And because it's there, cell phones, Wi-Fi, things that would emit any sort of electromagnetic radiation are banned so as not to interfere with the telescope's work. And from what I understand, there's around a dozen people living there that claim they suffer from EHS.
And they get to Green Bank, and what do they report about their symptoms?
They say that their symptoms are completely gone. They get wiped away because there's no electromagnetic radiation in the area. One person, Diane Scow, lived right in the heart of Green Bank. And another person, Nichols Fox, actually lived directly outside the quiet zone because she said that there was just too much radiation inside the quiet zone. I'm assuming she meant that the radiation was coming from the radio telescope itself. You know, when I showed up at Diane Scow's house, I had forgotten I had kept a cell phone in my pocket. I walked in and she immediately knew that I had a cell phone on me. She even sort of pointed to the pocket that it was in.
Kind of amazing. So they've settled into Green Bank now symptom-free, but how do they conduct the rest of their lives?
Diane Scow moved from Iowa to West Virginia, but in Iowa, before she left, her husband had built her a Faraday cage, an insulated metal cage that supposedly protects you from electromagnetic fields and radiation. And so Diane Scow was living inside one of these cages in Iowa for years before moving to Green Bank. She says that when she leaves the community, she immediately is affected by the cell phone towers that she passes on the highway. But, you know, to be honest, she leads a fairly normal life within the quiet zone. She has a computer that has a cable modem, you know, that's hardwired to the internet. She has a landline telephone, whereas Nichols Fox, who claims that her condition is a bit more severe, she has absolutely no electronic devices in her house whatsoever. Her refrigerator is powered by gas. She has gas lamps and reads by candlelight. When she turns up her thermostat to a certain level, heat is powered by electronic heaters, but that's only if she gets to the point of risking her life as a result of being so cold.
One of the things that struck me about your piece is that Green Bank is in this Wi-Fi free zone for fear of disturbing the radio telescope located there. But that's because the radio telescope is monitoring all of the radiation that just seeps naturally from the outside universe into the Earth's atmosphere, which makes me wonder if there is so much ambient radiation out there anyway. Why aren't these people affected equally by it as by the microwave oven or the cell phone?
There's different frequencies of radiation. You know, some are a lot weaker than others. And I would imagine that those living in Green Bank feel that the radiation coming in from space is just too weak to affect them. I mean, it's really just an extremely unusual community there.
But not a tinfoil hat crowd, right? I mean, these aren't people who believe that the FBI is sending signals into their brain.
A lot of these individuals are highly educated. I did not talk to one person that at least hadn't gone to college, or actually one person that hadn't gotten a degree after college. I talked to a lawyer. Nichols Fox is a former journalist. Diane Scow has her PhD, was an agricultural researcher before she left Iowa. I spoke to a physician. These people aren't the types of people that you would think you would encounter when reporting on a story like this.
Now, there's a kicker at the end of your piece, which is that there is a proposal being floated in and around Green Bank actually to put up some sort of cell phone tower. Where does that stand? Are these people going to be sent fleeing from their only refuge?
There's a proposal to set up a cell phone tower outside the quiet zone, right where Nichols Fox lives. And she says that she just doesn't know what she's going to do. If she comes within just several miles of a cell phone tower, she says she starts to break down. And that was sort of the sad part about the piece, is this woman who seems very grounded aside from this issue just has absolutely no idea where to go. So whether it's an illness or not, something is happening to these people. And frankly, after reporting on this and talking to a load of experts and a ton of people who say they suffer from this supposed condition, I'm not sure what to think.
All right, Matt, thank you so much.
No problem at all. Thank you for having me.
Matt Danzico is a journalist for the BBC in Washington. Coming up, do you have any disease or disorder of any kind? Do you take any medicine? This could be your lucky day. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. At GatesFoundation.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Under copyright law, for obvious reasons, it can be illegal to mass photocopy pages from a library book. So when in 2004 the Google Books Project began scanning thousands of books in university libraries to create a digital archive and greater access for scholars, it's no surprise that someone objected. A group called the Authors Guild, on behalf of its several thousand members, sued Google for copyright infringement. Eventually, the parties settled, creating what was in effect an online store for scholarly works, with the proceeds split between Google and the authors. But that settlement was thrown out by the court, which said the Authors Guild did not have the standing to represent the whole universe of authordom. That's when five universities themselves stepped in and decided to separate out the so-called orphaned works from the Google archive and make digital copies of them available within their own network. Whereupon the Authors Guild and its lawyers charged right back into the fray, alleging, quote, one of the largest copyright infringements in history. James Grimmelman has written about this lawsuit. James, welcome back to On the Media.
Great to be here.
Let's start with so-called orphan works. Can you tell me what that means?
An orphan work is a book that is under copyright, but the copyright owner just can't be found to ask permission to do anything with it, which means that it basically just sits there on the shelf. No one can print new copies of it. So it's this situation where the author's not making any money, but the public isn't getting more access to the book. What the libraries here have been proposed to do is to take some specific books, to do a search for the authors and the copyright owners, and if they can't turn them up, then just to make that book available within the library's own system. To the people who could have had access to the book by coming down physically to the library, they'll just get access to the digital copy. So the Authors Guild's concern here is that maybe some of its members will be mistakenly declared to be orphan owners.
What exactly has the court said about this legal argument forwarded by the Authors Guild?
Orphan works are really terra incognita for the legal system. We've known that there's a problem about this for a while. The Copyright Office and Congress have been thinking about it, but no one really knows what the exact law governing them is going to be. So in some ways, this current lawsuit is really the first serious chance the legal system will have to weigh in.
Let's just say that an author who had been out of pocket for whatever reason reemerges to reassert a claim on his own work or hers. Isn't that easily taken care of by removing the digital copy from the cache and resuming life as usual?
And that's exactly what the libraries are planning to do. They have a list of the books that they think might be orphans. And if a copyright owner emerges and says, that's my book, it gets taken out of the digital cache that's made available to borrowers and people using the library. They keep it in storage for preservation purposes so that if the physical copy gets damaged, they can replace it. And eventually, when the copyright expires, they'll be able to use the digital copy to cede the public domain.
Google had forged a settlement, and then the court threw it out. So who won this dispute? Where does it sit at this moment?
The court held that the Authors Guild, a membership organization of a few thousand authors, didn't have the standing to negotiate this comprehensive settlement on behalf of the millions of different copyright owners whose books Google had scanned.
So if the Authors Guild does not have the standing in court to represent all of these authors, living or maybe dead, who potentially could be harmed, does anybody?
That's a really good question. This may be the kind of large-scale copyright dispute that's simply beyond the capacity of the legal system or the courts to handle effectively. People have been saying for a while that we need Congress to step in and really clarify the rules for what digital books are going to be. And so far, Congress has been backing away from this one as fast as it can.
It sounds so theoretical, a whole lot of litigation over no specific harm, except that the public will be deprived of the works themselves.
I mean, everybody's looking for a way forward that makes books available to the public while compensating authors and publishers on fair terms. And maybe this is the right way, maybe this isn't, but you can see how everybody's trying to feel their way towards some kind of deal that's good for everyone. The Google Book case was a stab at that kind of a deal. It turned out to be not a very good way of doing it, and this is not something appropriate for a court to order. But Congress really does need to come in and find fair compromises here.
Well, I have no doubts that they'll take care of that promptly and with no political rancor.
Books. Who can be against books? Oh, wait.
James, once again, many thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
James Grimmelman is an associate professor at New York Law School, and he blogs at laboratorium.net. Shortly after we spoke to him, the plot of this story thickened. The Authors Guild posted articles seriously undermining the university's claim of due diligence in trying to locate the authors of the supposed orphan works. With what is described as a few phone calls and, quote, about 2 minutes of Googling, the Authors Guild located 4 authors whose works had been declared orphaned. Among them, The Communist World and Ours, by none other than writer, reporter, and journalism luminary Walter Lippmann. Of this revelation, Grimmelman on his blog wrote, "No one will ever be able to make the orphan works argument again without opponents bringing up the orphans that weren't." So you're on the sofa watching basic cable at 3 a.m., and you've just seen almost 9 uninterrupted minutes of a 1993 cop thriller, so on comes the commercial break.
Are you tired of having bad credit? Easy Credit Repair can help you regain control legally and affordably.
Tax Resolution Services can help you negotiate a settlement for pennies on the dollar.
I'm Otto Williams. Would an extra $1,000 come in handy right now? Then I'd like to talk to you about Money Mutual.
Oh, Montel. But there it is. You have been transported to the desperation zone, where hard luck is the motif and salvation is but a toll-free phone call away, especially if you have the good fortune to have your bad fortune, arguably, someone else's fault.
Attention antidepressant users. The FDA has associated the use of certain antidepressants with birth defects.
If you took Celexa, Lexapro, Paxil, Effexor, Zoloft, Prozac, or Prestique.
If you or a loved one were occupationally exposed to asbestos and have been diagnosed with mesothelioma.
Warning, Accutane has been pulled from the market. Serious side effects include inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, or colitis.
If there is any category of commercial that dominates the desperation zone, it is the lawyer ad, drumming up business with alarming correlations between exposure to certain substances,
usually prescription drugs, and some of the nastiest stuff ever.
If you ever took the acne drug Accutane or one of the generic versions, and you now suffer from Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, or inflammatory bowel disease, call the Relion Group now.
There was a time when TV commercials for lawyers didn't exist. They were deemed by the legal establishment to be barratry, the variously unseemly, unethical, and unlawful solicitation of clients, more commonly known as ambulance chasing. One simply did not go into public foraging for torts.
Before 1977, that would have been illegal in, I think, every state. And that had been the case for most of the 20th century.
Greg Beck is a lawyer for Public Citizen in Washington, D.C.
That changed completely in 1977 when the Supreme Court decided the case Bates versus Arizona Bar. And in that case, the Supreme Court said for the first time that the First Amendment protects lawyers in their advertisements.
If you've been injured on your job, you may need a lawyer, one who knows workers' comp and will fight hard to get you everything you're entitled to. I'm attorney Jim Sokoloff. My business is personal injury law.
Among the pioneers was Boston personal injury lawyer James Sokoloff, who thought that the law was a business like any other and could benefit from business thinking, such as expanding the marketplace. After dipping his toes in the water of print advertising, he ran a commercial aimed at victims of car crashes and then sat back waiting for the incoming. There was plenty.
We were overwhelmed with the amount of response that we received from consumers, and we were also overwhelmed by the amount of critique that we received from the organized bar.
Critiques in the form of public expressions of disdain from his more dignified peers. As his clientele grew, and as his caseload grew, and as his success rate grew, and as his fee revenue grew, the disdain substantially gave way to ad competition from or partnership with the very lawyers who had dismissed him as an embarrassment. 25 years later, his associates practice in 50 states and have accrued more than $1 billion in fees, plus perks.
The key to having spent all this money on TV advertising is I can get a reservation for dinner now, you know?
No surprise, then, that Sokoloff has many lawyers following in his footsteps. And for the faint of heart who do not wish to be seen as hucksters, advertisers such as the Relion Group troll for prospective clients, then sell the referrals to off-camera litigators. The Relion Group, a subsidiary of Lead Generation Technologies, funded by the Carlyle Group, doesn't itself employ any lawyers.
If you or a loved one have been diagnosed with bladder cancer after taking Actos, call the Relion Group now for a free legal consultation.
The question is, apart from scaring the bejeebers out of us in the middle of the night, what does tort television actually accomplish? To Elizabeth Tarbert, who regulates lawyer advertising for the Florida Bar Association, the answer is a lot. Millions of Americans who otherwise have little knowledge about, say, dubious drugs, much less the world of civil law, are provided information in the time it takes to order a ShamWow.
There may be many consumers who have no idea they may have a legal claim. So that is a purpose of lawyer advertising, is to inform consumers of their legal rights. Some people may find it distasteful, but again, we're not permitted to regulate on the grounds of taste.
On the contrary, one of the reasons all these ads look so down market is that regulators like the Florida Bar and its 49 equivalents, among them, prohibit the techniques and most of the sophistication, or at least the storytelling, seen in other categories of advertising. For instance, one Syracuse, New York lawyer had to go to federal court to protect his constitutional right to be ridiculous. Greg Beck of Public Citizen.
We represented a firm who had a variety of ads that were supposed to be funny and entertaining, including ads that sort of made the lawyers look like they were giants stomping around the city of Syracuse. And, for example, advising space aliens on personal injury claims.
Sounds like a Japanese movie from 1962.
They were kind of funny. They were silly. The bar does not like silliness, though. And it made clear that silly kinds of ads are the sorts of ads that the rule was supposed to prohibit.
Beck and his lawyer clients prevailed, but the victory provided little comfort to national advertisers like Jim Sokolov, who still must craft a single ad that will pass muster with every other jurisdiction. He began his TV advertising career using super slow-motion reenactments, and now just poses stiffly in front of a bookcase. Sokolov.
If we want to stay within regulation in all 50 states, we have to present in our media things that are very vanilla. We're dealing in a very, very restricted environment, which is not necessarily in the consumer's best interest.
There is also the question of the nation's best interests. Critics of the litigious society claim that obscene jury awards and countless nuisance lawsuits place an onerous burden on manufacturers and dedicated professionals. The counterargument, though, is that the looming threat of litigation, not to mention actual punitive damages, is a check and balance against greed and negligence. Furthermore, says Public Citizens Beck, the courts actually aren't clogged with mesothelioma claims triggered by cable TV.
The ad is just the first contact between the lawyer and a potential client, and a lawyer has no incentive to bring a case that cannot win. And so the next thing that happens is the client contacts the lawyer, and the lawyer evaluates the strength of the claim. If the lawyer at that point decides that the potential client has no case, then there's been no harm done.
Well, there's some harm done. If you're a person like, for example, me, who has seen several of his own daily medications associated with bad, bad, bad things. This is unnerving at 3 o'clock in the morning. Let's say that one, very hypothetically, once took Accutane and for the next 25 years has had, again, hypothetically, a bowel more irritable than Simon Cowell. And as long as we're just supposing, let's suppose that this person was well within the vast statistical majority and that one thing had absolutely nothing to do with the other.
Correlation or association is really based on observation. And it says that the people who take drug A have a different experience than the people who take drug B.
Gerald Delpan runs the Office of Surveillance and Epidemiology at the Food and Drug Administration.
It doesn't tell you why they have a different experience. It may be because of the drug, but it may be because they have other underlying illnesses or a host of other factors that independently predispose them to the adverse outcome, and it has nothing to do with the drug at all.
So if our hypothetical subject were to go rushing off to court to be compensated for 25 years of pain and suffering unrelated to Accutane, the tort reform crowd would be well within its rights to say, see, I told you so. On the other hand, if you don't want to be scared into filing frivolous lawsuits or even into shunning important medicines that you genuinely benefit from, lawyer James Sokolov prescribes a simple remedy. It is not the antidepressants Zoloft, Paxil, or Celexa, which have been associated with birth defects. It's something a little more basic.
One can always turn off the message.
Really? Turn it off?
I'm not a soap star or a game show host, but I've been on TV longer than most of them. I'm attorney Jim Sokolov. Some people ask, how can he be a good lawyer if he has to advertise? The truth is...
Excellent idea.
Are you a lawyer? Has someone you don't know been victimized by mesothelioma? Cancer, heart disease, kidney failure, hepatitis, stroke, migraine, depression, arthritis, asthma, or death. These are potential plaintiffs. Call 1-800-KACHING now. Parkinson's disease, Hansen's disease, Crohn's disease, Lou Gehrig disease, scurvy, gingivitis. Victims are everywhere. If you can't locate them, you may be suffering financial harm. Do not delay. Call now. You are entitled to advertise. These cases can yield large awards. Just pick up the phone. Call 1-800-KACHING now. Call 1-800-KACHING now.
This is an advertisement for advertising services. Advertising rules vary by state and jurisdiction. This is the part where I speak very, very fast. The words on your screen are too small to read. Now I'm talking even faster.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, and edited this week by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Rob Granis and Dylan Keefe. Special thanks to voiceover artist Donald James. Ellen Horn is WNYC's Senior Director of National Programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.